Juliet Dogcast Radio. If you like dogs, wherever you are in the world, we're the show for you. Hello and welcome to episode 75 of Dogcast Radio. Don't forget, if you've enjoyed the Buddy's Diaries fiction and articles on Dogcast Radio, there's now a Buddy's Diary book. You can see the Dogcast Radio website for further details, and buying the book helps support Dogcast Radio. In this show, we have a breed profile of an Australian Terrier.
They are incredibly people-friendly and loyal little dogs.
We have a short story from author Winfried Pepink, and we'll have the Dogcast Radio news. But before all that, we continue our interview with Matthew Culmore about settling a new puppy in. Matthew is a Bichon Frise breeder in California whose dogs produce highly rated litters. He knows how to minimise stress for a puppy transferring to his new home, and now you can know too. We discussed where the puppy should sleep on his first night in his new home, as well as how early to begin training. You can hear that in episode 74. Now I asked Matthew how much time he thought new owners needed to set aside to be with a new puppy, and how to gradually build in leaving them alone.
Well, considering the reality that most people work, I'm going to say in the majority of cases where a person gets their dog, it's in the approximately 10 weeks of age. So you're about 2.5 months, and at about 5 months, the dogs have really started to show and develop a lot of their direction, their discipline, their character, and depending on whether you are going to be able to be with the dog during that period of time. In other words, you can take the dog to work with you, or you work from home, or whether you are somebody that has to leave and leave the dog in their crate through the course of the day. On average, a puppy will hold its urine or defecation for about an hour per each month of age. So at about 6 months to 7 months, you're talking about a puppy that can normally hold it for 6 to 7 hours, which is not an unusual amount of time for a puppy to be in a crate if you're not around.
So you know, you can sort of ease them into that, presumably, and prepare them, you know, leave them a little bit at a time. Would you say people do need to take time off work initially so they can actually, you know, start, you know, particularly with toilet training, you're going to have to set that in motion. But what would you say there? Do people need to take time off work?
If you can, all the better. Still that bonding, that timing. Here's an example. People that do have the opportunity to work from home and have their dogs with them, by keeping them in a crate even near them, it's a good thing, because when the dog is in the crate and they start making any noise or anything like that, you then know that they're trying to tell you it's time for them to get out.
So you can sort of start their routine, you know, and use the crate still, and that will help to the toilet with the toilet training, won't it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But really, the more time you can spend in that formative period, absolutely. I'd love to be able to advocate everybody take the first 6 months off and stay at home with their pups. They'd have much better behaved pups.
And, yeah.
All that. But it is. That's a tough one. Some people that are not able to be around their puppies during the day end up finding, in many cases, they're more difficult to not only potty train, but to have the separation anxiety. And, you know, a lot of this comes back to, and while it's kind of difficult to address some of this, Patricia and I have, for a long period of time, taken the extra diligence to really get to know the families and to really try and not let people select us or our puppies, but for us to select them. And we try more often than not to find somebody that is a retired or they'll work at home family or family member or homeschooling is going on. We just find that the end result of the puppies is much, much better. And the relationships between the animals and their owners are much better. And as a result, we try and place them with families and someone that's going to be around. I don't think we have ever replaced a dog with a single person or someone that is traveling a lot or something like that. That's just been by our choice.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think there's two things. One, there's the dog's welfare. You know, you can't take
Absolutely.
Them from this nice warm litter with brothers and sisters and mom and dump them and say, right, you're on your own 8 hours a day. I don't think that's, you know, good for the dog. But the other thing is, for the person's sanity, it's blooming hard work. You know, having a puppy, it's great and it's fun and they're cute, but it's really hard work. And to hold, you know, to have a full-time job as well and cope with the puppy and give him or her everything he needs, it's hard work, isn't it?
Yes, and that's why you see such a proliferation of fabulous facilities coming online. I think everywhere here in Northern California, just they're everywhere of different kinds of doggy daycare and doggy boot camps and all of this stuff that are really like resorts. And some of the folks that are not going to be around their dogs in the formative periods of time, that would seem to be an extremely good and viable option for people that want to have a dog but can't be around them all the time. And sometimes professional help is needed. Actually, a couple of times we know of where our pups have immediately gone into professional training, you know, about the 5 to 6 month period of time, and have made just extremely outstanding pets as a result.
Yeah.
Because people are trained in doing what they do. People aren't trained in being dog trainers.
Yeah.
And rather than allow frustration to overwhelm you, sometimes it's always better to call for a little bit of help. And these are things that people have to, in our minds, and as we talk and interview folks, we see where their attitudes are. What would they do if this became a situation? Would they get training or would they give up? And that helps in our decision-making process with those people as well.
Yeah, yeah. And as you say, a professional can see things that you can't and just to make a little suggestion, and it makes a big difference to what you're doing. And sometimes you can't see it, can you?
Exactly. It's just like clicker training.
Yeah.
For people that have explored clicker training, it seems like you should be able to do it one way, and yet until you watch somebody or a video of someone using a clicker, it doesn't make as much sense. It seems backwards.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
That's just something that people that are adept in dealing with those behaviors, that's what they're there for.
Mm.
And I think that's one of the good things of having pedigreed dogs also, as opposed to your unpedigreed varieties, is people are going to pay a little bit more for them. They're expecting more of them, and they also expect that their investment is going to be greater in those animals than, let's say, a dog that they claim for $35 at a shelter.
Yeah, yeah. Did you want to say something about food, Matthew?
If you would like, as far as is once we get the food decision made, and we really believe, as with all products, the more expensive, the better. We have found in the United States that the wellness and science diet varieties offer outstanding stuff from puppies to adults. And as puppies, in that first 5 to 6 months of time, we try and give them feeding at least 3 times a day. As soon as they get up in the morning out of their crates, they're going to want to run outside, go to the bathroom, and then come in, eat, and then go back outside and take care of their business. You don't want to confuse playtime with either eat time or bathroom time. And we find that by feeding three times a day, that's 6 to 7 in the morning, around noon, and around 5, and allowing them to eat as much as they want. We'll start with a quarter to a half a cup of food per dog, per meal. But if they knock that out in a heartbeat, then give them more, because they are growing and growing fast. Whatever they haven't eaten in about 20 minutes' time, you do want to pick up and put away. As they move from that 6 months to the 1 year, you can usually knock that down to a 2 times a day, first thing in the morning, and then around 5 o'clock, say, breakfast and dinner for most family times. And you should find that they will not only eat with a great deal of vigor, but you should also try and avoid any kind of table scraps, treats, soft items, and stay with a good, dry, hard kibble. It's good for their teeth. Also, medium to large size, either dog bone, like milk bones, or whatever treat chews. And we like to use the larger sizes as opposed to the little small sizes. We think that it does a better job of cleaning the teeth just by having more area to grind and chew on. And even in the dog kibbles, we prefer the larger kibbles for that same reason. It's a little harder for them to chew, and as a result, keeps their teeth a little bit cleaner. And as you get into about the 1 year, you can either stay with the 2 times a day, morning and dinner time, or go to a once-a-day feeding. Or in the case of what we do with our dogs, we do what we call free choice, which is we leave both water and food down as they become adults in one area, not a lot, but down, so in case they want to go over and have a little snack, they can. And needless to say, water at all times for the dogs, except when they're in that first 5 to 6 months. You want to be giving it in a more controlled period of time. And you don't want to give them water, obviously, before they go into their crate or anything like that. Anytime they have that water, you want to make sure that they've had a good thorough drink and gone outside before you put them away, and then they'll sleep and relax that much better.
Yeah. Is there anything else that you would like to, you know, you feel people really need to know about settling the puppy in?
Well, I guess you could go down a lot of different paths with that. From the behavior during that period that he is a puppy, you do want to realize that while they were little pups, chewing and nipping and doing all that was really acceptable and all, but as they're growing up, you don't want them chewing and nibbling on virtually everything. So we like having those little leather chew sticks, kind of little cigarette-looking things. We like to have those by the dozens everywhere. So if they get into something, whether they're chewing on or just kind of running wild, or you want to just take their actions off of something, we use the replacement therapy by always having something that they can chew on and be distracted by. And then I guess you could get into a whole area of further house training and the things that go along with that. But I guess I would probably want to close more so by saying anything that we find that at about probably 48 to 62 hours that a person really should, and I know this is backing up a little bit, make sure that they have already set up an appointment with their vet to have that puppy looked over. While it'll have already seen vets while with the breeder and had shots, you still want to take it to your vet, let them look it over and give them a good checkup, and then set up your vaccination schedule and be sure and take in stool samples. Because, again, that's what we were talking about. Those dogs will be sniffing. And even though you're going to try and limit the areas and places he can sniff at, there's still a good chance that a stray animal may have put something in the yard. So make sure that you take in a stool sample. And while there, be sure, anytime you go to the vet's, take your own towel or other blanket or whatever. Because in those doctor's offices, that is... Remember, most people are going there because their dog is sick. So So you want to have towels or something that you can put the dog on in the waiting room and when they're on the scale or treatment tables, and also get your dog microchipped.
Yes, yeah, definitely. That's brilliant advice as ever, Matthew. If people want to find out more, they can go to your website, which we will have a link to on the Dogcast site, and there's more information they can find there, isn't there?
Yes, correct. And there's a downloadable form under the Bichon Frise care guide area that gives a lot further detail on some of the things you and I have discussed today. And while it, keeping in mind that that is scaled in certain ways for Bichons, it's adaptable to all dogs, only just the feeding amounts, perhaps crate size, or a few other items. But, yeah, we think that it's a good general guide. And by any options that anyone sees in there that they would like to add to it, further the discussion on it, please have them feel free to contact us so we can include it and hopefully expand this little guide and make it good for everybody.
The proof of Matthew's advice is in the happy, healthy, confident puppies he breeds. To find out more, visit the Culmore Canines website, where Matthew would love to have feedback and contributions. I think the other thing to bear in mind with a puppy is to remember to make the most of it, because before you know it, they're all grown up. Every boy who has a dog should also have a mother, so the dog can be fed regularly. Unknown. You're listening to Dogcast Radio on www.dogcastradio.com. And now, A Phoenix in Black and White, written by Winfried Pepink, read by Julie Hill. When the diplomatic dog, Dee Dee, died suddenly on the 14th of May, our grief was profound. For a long time afterwards, we reminisced about his mannerisms and his favourite things, sniffling often to surreptitiously wipe away a forming tear. We recalled his favourite walks, the way he sat dutifully on command, and the way he circled behind the front door while we fumbled with keys. We missed his minute inspection of suitcases when we came back from holiday, looking for the fluffy toy he knew that we always brought. We saw him everywhere, strutting, sniffing, or curled up asleep. Miss Lucy missed him too, for she wore a forlorn look on her face, like the look that an errant husband might expect from a saddened spouse waiting by the window, hoping for a return. It served to compound our misery, and we gave her extraordinary attention, which in turn merely served to compound her own misery. "Why is all this happening?" she seemed to ask. Dogs have a way of knowing things have changed. She realised he had gone forever when she moved and slept on the sheepskin that Dee Dee always jealously guarded as his own little acre. She told us with her eyes, always bulging in welcome, but now shrunken inwards and cast downwards, like those of a basset hound, as she quietly mourned his passing. We talked a great deal about getting a companion for Miss Lucy, quite like one did in Victorian times for a suddenly widowed aunt, someone to sit with in the sitting room, to talk and knit and get interminable cups of tea while saying, "Yes, dear," and "Is that so?" Someone to help end the lonely vigil for one who is not coming back. My wife said that it was too early and that it just wouldn't be right to get another when the memories of Dee Dee are still so fresh. "It would be for Lucy," I advanced, softly and cautiously. But she demurred, and I backed off. "We will get one when the time is right for Lucy and for us," she opined with a finality that in Victorian times would have seen me reach for my pipe and slippers and get out my copy of Great Expectations, or maybe Bleak House. 2 months later, my wife was doing volunteer duty at the local Bahrain Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. The summer rush had started. People no longer enamoured with puppies simply dumped them outside the gates. Others, going on the long summer holiday and not wanting to be bothered by cats and dogs at home, took a similar course. Or otherwise, they simply turned them loose, at a time when the daytime temperature reaches 50 degrees and water sources are scarce. The BSPCA was full, and already pets had been euthanized, that wonderfully humane word which gives disposed of a prettier dress. And now, here were two fellows at the gate with yet another puppy. "We'll put him to sleep," said the overworked manager. "Euthanized" seemed too big a word to be understood by the labourers who had brought him in, but they understood putting to sleep all right, and the disappointment showed in their faces. My wife took a look at the tiny puppy, a collage of black and white, and in an instant said, "I'll take him." The look on the face of the labourer, who held the puppy by the scruff of the neck, lest it turn on him like a loosened lion, was of relief and gratitude. Her thanks were profuse, and she scooped him up as though he was a baby, and gave him possibly the first cuddle he had ever had in the entire period of his short life. He sat quietly while she prized off 100 ticks, the fear in his eyes wide and darting, and when she put him on the floor, he raced under a desk, like a rabbit, into a deep, dark burrow. Later, when she brought him home, he wagged his tiny tail, a black licorice strap with a white arrowhead at the end, at Miss Lucy, in recognition of a fellow of the species. She just gave him a cursory glance, as though he was below-stairs staff, and assumed her best Queen Victoria mantle, the distaste manifest on her face. "We are not amused," it said. My wife was still out to lunch when I got home. Miss Lucy came to the door, as she always does when the key is inserted in the lock. But this time there was no smile where her top lip is curiously curled, and workmen leap back because they think she is about to bite. No, this time her look was searching. "What is this all about?" it said. I gulped to answer and say, "Good dog," as I usually do, but she turned her head away like a mistress in a tiff. My words were strangled into a mere "goo," as out of the door emerged a gangly smudge. His tail wagged once, like those old vacuum windscreen wipers that moved ever so slowly, and he shot off as soon as I said, "Hi, little fella." Miss Lucy looked dismissively over her shoulder at the intruder, and then back to me, with a look of pure contempt. At the sound of my voice, the puppy tried to burrow into an impossibly small space beside our bed, and somehow it succeeded. It was the male voice, I thought, as generally it is the males here that do the abusing and stone-throwing. For an instant, I thought of morphing into Tiny Tim, but any attempt at falsetto was only likely to scare the puppy more. So I reached in and grabbed him. For a moment, we both tugged in opposite directions, in a contest that he was always going to lose. Then I held him close to me, to show I meant no harm. It was a bit like cradling a wafer, his ribs showing like folds in the earth that you see in the Badlands of Dakota, his tiny heart pounding like the breakers at Bondi. He was jet black of hue, with the skin of an otter, and gawky legs that resembled a tiny camel, big paws and the head of a pointer. But unlike the bulk of Bahraini desert dogs, which have a pointed snout like a collie dog, and with eyes far too close together to be trustworthy, this little tyke had a handsome face. He was black on either side of a white median strip blaze that ran to his pinkish undernose, but which looked as though it had been splotched with oil spots. Two soft big black ears fell from the top of his head like loincloths. When I cradled him and looked at his belly, it was clear that a Dalmatian had played a role in his pedigree. I patted him for quite a while and spoke soothingly, much, I'm sure, to Miss Lucy's annoyance, and when I put him down, he swayed like the pictures of a suspension bridge during an earthquake, but he did not run away. It has been 2 weeks now since we got him, and he has taken over our lives. The vet said he was healthy and might have a bit of Great Dane in him. "Lovely nature, but they eat a lot," she said. My wife and I argued about his name. She wanted to call him Elvis, but in the now or never option, I went for the latter. Sure, his pelvis wiggled when he walked, but the thought of him growing fat was not endearing. I went for a local Arabic name, Baba, but again, thoughts of an elephantine girth came into it, and rejection followed. Yusuf and Mumtaz, magnificent, also got short shrift, and then we settled on Harry Lyme, the shady character played by Orson Welles in The Third Man, the greatest black-and-white film ever. Whether he will live up to such a top billing is anyone's guess, but we have plucked him from obscurity and given him a starring role. You can no longer see his ribs, for his daily searching for scraps is no more. Like Miss Lucy, he feasts on chicken and fish and lies beside her on the carpet. He growls over his little chopped bone, just as Dee Dee used to do over his. What is his, and what is Lucy's, is his too. He sleeps, when he sleeps, on Dee Dee's sheepskin rug, and he plays with the fluffy toys that Dee Dee accumulated in the 6 years that he spent with us. He's a bit more timid than Dee Dee was, but like Dee Dee, he is learning to trust, and now scampers up to people, wagging his tail when he hears us greet them. He and Miss Lucy have grown surprisingly close, and when they're not wrestling, he going for the knee bite bring down, she for the rollover splat, he curls up next to her. She looks down on him with a sphinx-like serenity, and says, "Sleepy time, little boy." They share their food, although he sometimes likes to flaunt a chewing stick like an ice cream at the beach, long after she has devoured hers. When he has eaten enough, and hides remnants in the clothes basket, she keeps a weather eye open, and later, like Sherlock Holmes, sniffs out the clues. With nary an elementary, dear lime, she removes Exhibit A for safekeeping, and he appears to be none the wiser. It is scant payment, no doubt, for sharing her food, and time, and walks, with a puppy that teases her mercilessly, and sometimes hurls himself at her with all the force of a furry cannonball. Harry Lyme has learned to walk around the block on the lead, and socialise with other dogs. He still pees in an ungainly squat, but hopefully, and in time, some of the boys will take him aside and show him how it's done. His bark is coming on, a bit Rod Stewartish at present, but he has real potential as a crooner, the way he tilts back his head like a wolf and bays into the sky. People told us that getting over the sudden death of Dee Dee would take time. They are half right. Like a dear friend, which is what Dee Dee was, he is never forgotten. But now Harry Lyme walks in his footsteps. Oh, Harry would have annoyed the hell out of Dee Dee, I'm sure, and the old boy would have taken himself away and given Harry Lyme a nip if he came a-following. I'd like to think that if we had got Dee Dee soon enough, instead of after a year on the run, he would have been just like Harry Lyme, friendly, playful and a zest for life, the joy full in his eyes that every waking minute is destined to be fun. Harry Lyme is the lucky puppy that Dee Dee never was. And when we return to Australia, one day, as we promised to Dee Dee, we hope that Harry Lyme will be in the dog box we had planned would carry Dee Dee there. Somehow, I think that Dee Dee, on high, will look down on that plane, winging over the Indian Ocean, and say, "Well done, little fella." That was A Phoenix in Black and White, written by Winfried Pepink, read by Julie Hill. If you would like to find out more about Winfried Pepink's book about Dee Dee, The Diplomatic Dog of Barbados, click the link on the Dogcast Radio site. Beware of a silent dog and still water, Latin proverb. Would you recognise an Australian terrier if you met one? They sound a delightful little dog, and after talking to breeder Doreen Simpkins, I really like the sound of them. Here, Doreen explains what they look like.
An Australian Terrier is quite a sturdy, robust little dog. It's quite low-set, a bit longer in proportion to its height. It is untrimmed, it's got a harsh rough coat with a definite ruff round the neck. It has a soft undercoat. They come in two colours, blue and tan, and an all-over tan, which for some reason is called red. it's got a very, very friendly, very outgoing extrovert nature. It should have quite small, erect ears. Quite a strong jaw, because bearing in mind that what they were bred for was killing snakes and vermin in the outback in Australia. Mm. It's just a superb dog. Why it's not more popular in this country, I'm not sure. It has a very sort of bouncy, springy action, very nice driving movement, and altogether they're adaptable, they're intelligent, they're alert little dogs. Mm. Full of mischief. They've got a lot to offer as family dogs.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you've given us a glimpse there, but tell us more about what it's like to actually live with one, then.
Oh, It's well, we have 4 adults in the house and we have the 10 puppies in the house. I always have puppies born in the house because I believe that's absolutely central to good socialisation.
Mm.
But having an adult in the house means that you have wonderful company, you have amusement at their antics. They are incredibly people-friendly and loyal little dogs.
Mm.
They enjoy... they're dogs who need stimulation. I mean, all dogs need company and stimulation, but I think terriers are really quite intelligent little dogs and value your company. As a family pet, they are equally suitable in the town, in the country. We have people who have puppies of ours or dogs of ours who live in the town and live near a park or have a family garden, and the dogs are really exercised there. They are a constant companion. If my husband's away in business, I never feel as though I'm on my own because the dogs are just such company. And quite often, you don't have to speak to them all the time. I call it communing with your dogs.
Mm.
You kind of have this almost this feeling of connection with them. And they always have a lovely, amused expression on their face. And they always look as though they're smiling and happy. And people quite often comment on that. So they are terrific company.
Yeah, yeah. Now, they as you say, they do sound a really lovely dog. What are they like within a family? You know, do they attach more to one person? Or do they, you know, love everybody equally? What are they like there?
I think they just love company. As I said, you know, they are very friendly and extrovert and outgoing. They're quite anxious to please. They aren't more fixed on myself than they are on my husband, for example. And as I said, they are adaptable. I mean, we have rehomed an adult dog to an older couple who were looking at first for a puppy. And because of the husband's health issues, we talked it through and we were considering rehoming this adult dog. And this dog had never had any real contact, regular contact with children, but has been absolutely wonderful with the couple's grandchildren.
Mm.
Rock solid in terms of temperament.
Yeah.
No problems at all.
Oh.
Just lovely family dogs.
Yeah, yeah. Aw. Now, you've said that they were bred for sort of killing snakes and was it vermin in the outback?
That's right.
Yeah. We've got this dog that's full of character. So what's training like and what motivates them?
I think with training, you need to be quite patient. When we have a litter, for example, we have a litter and we try and keep perhaps one puppy for showing. And we look at doing very, very short regular training sessions. That's much, much better than one long training session once a week. They are, as I say, they respond well to treats when you're starting to train them as young dogs, but you don't always need to use those when they're older, because equally a pat or, you know, good dog or well done is just as effective in getting them to kind of want to do what it is you're wanting them to do.
Mm.
I'm always very careful when we have owners of pups that they know that they need to be in charge instead of the dog, because otherwise you can have a dog which is out of control, doesn't have good manners and really isn't a pleasure to be around. So training is central, motivation, praise, little food treats to begin with, and really about understanding your dog's communication. And I try and advise owners regarding, well, in fact, they get a puppy care information document, which is fairly lengthy and covers training and diet and coat care and health and all this kind of thing. And I try and give people perhaps a reading list of books that which they might find useful with regard to training. And I attempt to sort of I go towards a holistic approach to training. Mm. It's not just sheer obedience. It's everything else to do with the care of your dog. And it's about acknowledging, I think, that different dogs have different personalities and you need to use different approaches for them.
Mm.
And you can use that through different training methods, whether that's, you know, you use some Tellington touch for some dogs, whether it's some dogs might respond to clicker training, whether it's, you know, the dog listening approach, you know, and some of the books that are around just now regarding understanding canine body language are quite useful as well.
Mm. Mm. Yes, it's helpful if it's a two-way street, isn't it? And you can see what effect what you're doing is having on the dog.
Well, I think people have to be open-minded enough, you know, somebody says, oh, the dog did X. Right, what was leading up to that situation? What factors were in play there? And sometimes I have a small business as a dog listener, and sometimes I go out to do a consultation. And when you get a really full history and you kind of, you can identify factors and you can say, well, actually, you know, this has happened and that has happened and that, and then people think, oh, of course, I hadn't thought of that.
Mm.
You know, it's about being open-minded, I think, to consider the dog's point of view. If it's had lots of changes, if there's been lots of issues, if it's been on, you know, it's had a health problem and might have been in pain and it's behaved differently, because getting people to understand that sort of thing is so important, I think, to improving the relationship that people have with their dogs.
Yeah, yeah, definitely, definitely. Are they intelligent?
Oh, goodness me. I find them very, very intelligent. Obviously, that varies with individual dogs, but they are very quick on the uptake, and they are very quick, I think, to spot if you're not going to be consistent in your approach to training, for example.
Mm.
I liken it to, you know, having children. You know, a child will know when it's been given the parameters, and if it knows that it can go to the other parent and say, oh, Dad, can I have... With a dog, if it knows that it can sit at the table and look up at you and beg, and you will eventually be given it a piece of food or whatever, then it'll keep doing it.
Mm.
If you're consistent in your approach and you just don't do that, then the dog, there's nothing in it for them, and they just go and lie down.
Yeah.
But they are incredibly intelligent, yes.
Mm.
But then, that, you know, I think dogs have been bred for different purposes, and that means that they have different, you know, sort of strengths, I think. And certainly within the breed, that's a strength.
Yes, yeah. It always is quite irritating that every dog will pick up quicker on things you don't want them to pick up than things you're trying to train to them, you know. You think, well, there's obviously more motivation somehow in this. But never mind. How much exercise do they need?
Well, it varies. If you have an average-sized family garden, they'll get plenty of exercise in that. We have placed dogs with people who go hill walking, and the dog quite happily accompanies them.
Mm.
We have other people who live in a more built-up environment, and, you know, they'll go for a walk round the block or to the local park or whatever, and they're happy with that. I think, you know, people are sometimes conditioned in this country to think that, you know, I've got to tramp out for miles through wind, rain, hail, and, you know, it's not necessarily what the dog wants. Australian Terriers, if you try and put them out the door when the rain's on, will look at you with, you must be joking, on their faces.
Mm.
You go.
They
will walk for as long as you want them to walk. We're lucky enough here in that we have over an acre of garden. So we're in the position where we can have a lovely walk around the garden, and they enjoy the different sort of corners of that. You know, sometimes people have a smaller garden, and yes, it's nice to get out. And one of the advantages of having a well, any dog, but an Aussie is such a happy, smiling looking dog that when you're out walking and you pass anyone, they will speak to you in a way that if you were walking on your own, people tend not to. But they enjoy their walks, they enjoy running about the garden, they will quite happily, I think, adapt to what is okay for yourself and your family situation.
Yeah. When they are out and about, what's their attitude to strange people and strange dogs?
Well, an Aussie, although it's a terrier, it's not an aggressive dog. It will defend itself if it's attacked, as any terrier would, because, you know, that's what they were bred for.
Yeah.
But they enjoy meeting people, and when they meet other dogs, you see the usual sort of canine greeting body language, you know, as the tails are wagging and they go up to one another and sniff one another out. So they're not fearful or shy or retiring. None of those descriptions covers an Australian Terrier.
Okay, do you know, a lot of what you're saying is ringing true with our Bichon Frise. We have a Labrador and a Bichon Frise. And the Bichon, if you open the door and it's raining, she'll look at you like, I can hold it, I don't need to go, you know, out to the toilet or anything. And she's so sort of confident and friendly out and about, whereas our Labrador is much more passive, and he's sort of, you know, he is, when you were saying about they're not shy and retiring, our Labrador is. But, I mean, this is why we fall for different breeds, isn't it?
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, tell us about grooming with an Australian then.
Well, grooming with an Australian Terrier or for an Australian Terrier isn't a hugely time-consuming business. The coat is quite harsh and straight, dense top coat, under the softer undercoat. So regular combing and brushing. I advise pet owners to comb or brush at least once a week, particularly paying attention to underneath the front legs where it might get tangled, and underneath the tummy for dogs where it might get a little bit sticky. They don't need bathing terribly often, you know, once every 8 to 10, 12 weeks. And, you know, I try and get pet owners to recognise that grooming is something that the dog finds quite enjoyable, and it can be a sort of one-to-one time between you and the dog. And it's also an opportunity for a quick health check. You can check for the skin problems, you can check to see if there's any fleas or ticks that there shouldn't be there. It allows you to, you know, perhaps notice health problems early and be able to do something about them. But they don't need a huge amount of grooming. Before we went into Australian Terriers, we bred and showed Yorkshire Terriers. And now that's a different kettle of fish altogether in terms of coat care. But the average Australian Terrier family pet companion dog, combing once a week, bathing. If you do have the dog groomed by a professional groomer, I always advise people to make sure that they will hand strip the coat and not clip it, because clipping alters the texture and you get a much better finish if you hand strip the coat. When I'm grooming the show Aussies, which I do little and often because it's easier on the dogs if you do it that way. You know, you're hand stripping, you're trimming the hair around the ears, you're trimming the hair around the tail and the feet. And as I say, just going through all the checks, making sure that the ears aren't smelly, which might indicate ear mites, checking that the teeth are all right, is the plaque building up, what should you do about it, making sure that the nails are kept short, checking the anal glands, that sort of thing. And it's just a lovely one-to-one time between you and the dog, which they really respond to.
Yes, they do, don't they? Yeah. From what you're saying, it sounds like they don't shed.
They don't shed a great deal. What I would say is if you don't groom them regularly, you will get more coat loss on the furniture and things like that. But it's not like some breeds, you know, where you know, a yellow or a black lab where, you know, there is a lot of shed here.
Yes.
The combing, the brushing, that kind of attention to the coat will help keep that under control. And it is one of the breeds where people who say, you know, oh, well, there's allergies in the family. It is one of the breeds where you tend to find that there isn't the same issue over allergies. We have had one couple whose son was asthmatic who said, can we come? We are very keen on the breed. We've read up on it and researched on it. Can we come and we'll know within 15 to 20 minutes whether there's going to be a problem.
Yeah.
And I have to say there absolutely wasn't. And that wee dog is now over with that family in Germany, giving the three boys lots of fun.
Lovely. Oh, that's smashing. Is there any health issues that sort of anybody that's going to think about buying an Australian Terrier, what do they need to ask about health?
Well, with health, we're very fortunate in the breed in that there aren't a lot of health problems. That's one of the attractions for many people, is that they are that sturdy, robust, fairly healthy dog that you don't actually have to be taking along to the vet surgery every second week because of problems. There have been a few cases of diabetes in older dogs. You know, you're talking middle-aged dogs of 8, 9, 10, when, you know, just like humans, our bodies start breaking down as well when we're older. There are one or two cases of knee joint problems. Now, it's difficult to say whether, because they are very active and they do tend to run and jump and leap, and it can be quite difficult, particularly when you have a younger dog, trying to make sure that doesn't happen. It's difficult to know whether that's, you know, a genetic thing or whether it's an environmental thing.
Yeah,
where, you know,
yeah,
too much stress has been put in the joint. What I tend to encourage pet owners to do is to look at the diet and how you can help protect not just the joints, but also help the general health of the dog through the diet. And that might be making sure that the dog gets the pilchards with all the omega oils in it, perhaps looking at a supplement like linseed oil, which is one of the best sources of omega oils, you know, to help protect. And it's all about making sure, keeping your dog as healthy as possible. And the omega oils, not just the joints, it gives a superb gloss to the coat, it helps prevent skin problems, and it really just keeps them in tip-top condition. So there isn't a lot of health issues at all. We're very fortunate because, as a breed in the UK, people have made efforts to import stock from overseas to try and keep a diversity of bloodlines going. And in the last 10, 15 years, people have imported from America, from Australia, New Zealand, from the continent, particularly Finland and Sweden, where the breed's very strong. So breeders have been quite responsible in trying to ensure that there's a diversity of bloodlines, because overall, in terms of health, there was only 38 puppies born in the UK last year.
Good call.
And that's down on the previous 2 years when it was 62. I think everyone in the breed who shows and who breeds is very aware of the healthy nature of the dog as part of the overall package, part of the overall attraction for people.
Yeah, yeah. I think as well, sometimes when it isn't one of the more popular breeds, you don't suffer. You know, sometimes they suffer from their own success, don't they? And they do get overbred because there's a market for them. And I think sometimes, you know, that's a disadvantage, isn't it?
Well, I think you'll find in Australian Terriers, and as I say, I mean, we've been associated with them now for about 14 years. Ian's, my husband, he's vice chair of the Australian Terrier Club of Great Britain. I'm on the committee, and I'm also chairman of the Southern Counties Australian Terrier Club, the other breed club in the UK. And people are quite responsible and are very careful about where the puppies go. It's not been one of the hugely popular breeds, and quite often that's why we try and make sure that we get a good mix of dogs at Discover Dogs, at Crufts, and in November as well, at Discover Dogs in November, because people come along and say, oh, I've never seen one of these before.
Yeah.
It's almost like a chicken and an egg situation in terms of supply and demand.
Yes.
People have never seen them, so that, and then once they do, they think, oh, that's wonderful. You know, they, oh, aren't they lovely?
Yeah.
You know? And that's what they're looking for. I think overall, they have a superb... I'm just looking at something. There was Australian Terrier Club of Great Britain had their open show at the end of March, on the 30th of March, and that was judged by a gentleman called Albert White, who is a very well-known judge, judges a lot abroad as well as in this country. In fact, he judged Best in Show at Crufts a few years ago. And if I can just quote a little excerpt from his write-up and report on the results. He says, one has to admire the optimism and spirit of supporters of minority breeds, and of course these totally charming little characters do belong to those which lag well behind in the number of annual registrations and show entries. That is a great shame, as these delightful dogs proved here to be totally disarming in temperament, outgoing, showy and full of joie de vivre, suggesting that they should make engaging companions, which I thought was a lovely comment from somebody who judges all breeds all over the world, you know?
Yeah.
I think it says something for the breed.
Definitely, definitely. You have made them sound a really ideal dog, you know. I often feel this when I go away, but particularly today, that I'm thinking, oh, I'm going to look into this. I fancy an Australian Terrier one day. You know, you have made them sound very good.
Aww.
You're obviously very enthusiastic about it. So perhaps if we finish with sort of why you love them so much.
Well, why I love them so much is they give you so much in return. They are such a responsive, wonderful, just attractive little dog. And I cannot imagine life without a dog. I saw how much my late father had one of our dogs after his old dog passed away, and he had 9 years of happy life with Barney before Dad passed away. And it made so much difference to his life, and they make so much difference to mine. To Ian and I, you know, it's a major part of our life. We enjoy showing. We enjoy helping the breed. We enjoy talking to the public at Discover Dogs. And we just enjoy spreading the message about what Australian Terriers can mean to people and the sheer joy and pleasure that they can bring.
Don't they sound lovely? You can find out more about Doreen and her dogs at her website, haveahappyhand.co.uk. And you can see photos of some of her Australian Terriers on the Dogcast Radio site. You may have a dog that won't sit up, roll over, or even cook breakfast, not because she's too stupid to learn how, but because she's too smart to bother. Rick Horowitz.
Hello and welcome to the Dogcast Radio News Desk. I'm Nick.
And I'm Kate. On today's programme, we start with an update on what is going on in the dog world each side of the Atlantic. In the UK, in the wake of the uproar caused by the BBC documentary Pedigree Dogs Exposed, the Kennel Club is preparing to make some big changes. The Kennel Club with dog charity Dog Trust is calling for a review of dog breeding. They want an independent review into the registration, breeding and showing of dogs to ensure their long-term health and welfare. In addition, they want the government to support the initiative. This comes hot on the heels of the Kennel Club's announcement that they intend to review all 209 breed profiles by early next year and put emphasis on health rather than appearance, and have called on the government to give them legal powers to enforce health tests and codes of ethics.
Meanwhile, in Pennsylvania, America, House Bill 2525, nicknamed the Puppy Mill Bill, was approved. It will mean improvements to the care and housing of dogs in over 600 commercial kennels. Dogs will now have to be kept in bigger cages with regular exercise and veterinary checks and care. So, the future's brighter for dogs in the UK and the US.
But in our next story, a dog thankfully helped prevent the future for one householder getting a whole lot brighter. Police in Gloucestershire in the UK found themselves dealing with a very tense situation when a man filled his house with gas and threatened to blow it up. Then stepped forward German Shepherd Jedi, who entered the house with a video camera strapped to his back. The police could then view the footage he took, which enabled them to enter and arrest the man in question.
Since we're talking about a police dog called Jedi, I guess you could say the Force was with him. And moving along, it's coming up to Halloween again. While we love to be scared, our dogs don't, and the American Veterinary Association is warning owners to make sure their dog spends Halloween happy. Do be aware that putting on a costume or mask might spook your dog, and the constant doorbell ringing of trick-or-treaters may unsettle him too. Try putting him in a quiet room or in his crate or other safe place with a favourite toy. Be aware that while dogs prefer treats to tricks, many human foods are dangerous for canines. Make sure that children don't give dogs any sweets, and definitely no chocolate, as it can kill dogs.
Talking about children, sweets and chocolate, Australian researchers have found that having a dog makes children slimmer and healthier than their dogless counterparts. Amazingly, a family dog lowers a child's chances of being overweight by 50%. Even if youngsters don't actually walk the dog, the fact that they are more active by spending time playing with the dog is enough to have an effect. The study looked at over 1,100 children aged 5 to 12 and is published in the Health Promotion Journal of Australia.
However, in contrast to this, owning a dog didn't stop Kevin Pyle being named as one of the laziest men in Britain. He owns a bull mastiff called Bruce, an active dog that surely must need a lot of exercise, so how could he get away with being lazy? Kevin has come up with an unusual solution to meet Bruce's exercise needs. He gets his son to drive him slowly around the block while he holds Bruce's lead out of the window. It's not a traditional method, and it certainly isn't one that the Dogcast radio team would recommend. And that's all from us on the news desk. Goodbye.
For me, a house or an apartment becomes a home when you add one set of four legs, a happy tail, and that indescribable measure of love that we call a dog. Roger Karras. In episode 60, we told you about Jodie Wright's book featuring beautiful paintings of dogs, 50 Secrets Humans Should Know. Now, Jodie has posted a video on YouTube showing what the process of one of her paintings involves. Very interesting to watch. It makes me wish I could paint, but I'll have to stick with words and my trusty camera. Have you decided what to give your dog for Christmas? The shopping days left until Christmas are fast running out. If you do treat your dog to a present, or even a doggy advent calendar, send us photos of your Christmas canine celebrations. And if you are looking for Christmas presents, here's a message from Buddy.
If you enjoy Buddy's Diary on Dogcast Radio, you might be interested to know that there's now a book available. It has loads of my diary in it, as well as the great short stories and interesting articles from Dogcast Radio, plus some stuff you haven't heard or seen before. If you're looking for a Christmas present for a dog lover, or you know someone who would enjoy Dogcast Radio but doesn't have internet access, or maybe you'd just like to treat yourself, check out Buddy's Diary plus Fiction and Short Stories from Dogcast Radio. You'll find more details on the Dogcast Radio website. And don't I look handsome on the front cover. See you soon.
Till next time, look after yourselves and your dogs.
Thanks for listening to Dogcast Radio, available from www.dogcastradio.com. That's dogcastradio.com. If you'd like to get in touch with us, and wherever you are in the world, we'd love to hear from you. You can do so in a variety of ways. By phone from the UK, you can contact us on 0121 288 0922. From the US, you can contact us on our American number, which is 315-849-2022. From any other country, you'll need your international exit code and then 44121-288-0922. You can contact us on Skype with the ident Dogcast Radio. That's all one word, Dogcast Radio. By email, you can contact me on Julie@dogcastradio.com.
radio.com. When contacting us by email, if you have the facilities, please record your questions or comments and send them to us as an audio file. That way we can include them directly in our programme. We can accept most formats, for example, WAV, MP3. All these methods of contacting us can be found on our website, which is www.dogcastradio.com. And as ever, the final word goes to Jenny.
What kind of dog sniffs out new flowers? A bloodhound!